supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Less than 35 years, and the chance of the democratically controlled legislature passing a tax cut gets slimmer. As Harrison says,
this is kind of like a 1-2 economic punch for the governor.
Governor Christie's office didn't return calls for comment. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCrory.
In sports, the Phils dropped a second game to Milwaukee, 6-2. Game 3 is tonight at 7:10. This is WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we got one of those jam-packed shows for you today. We're going to talk about how you can use corn gluten meal right around now, over the next couple of weeks, to prevent weeds next season. We're also going to have a very important interview about how you can landscape against ticks and personally protect yourself against ticks when you're out in high brush or in the woods or places like that. It's a lot of important stuff to get to, so we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Lee, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Lee. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. And where is Lee Great?
I'm great in Havertown, Pennsylvania.
Just outside of Philadelphia.
That's right.
All right, what can we do you for?
When we bought our house in Havertown a couple of years ago, it came with a pretty good-sized koi pond in the backyard next to the garage.
You sent me an emailed picture.
I did,
of
yes.
This. Can I call it a monstrosity?
Well, it's kind of verging on that, isn't it?
We're going to put a picture of this, quote, koi pond up on our website. But I'll tell our listeners that when most people think of a koi pond, they think of a pond that is the same level as the ground. Yours has this widowmaker wall of rocks around it that would have permanently disabled my legs by now in that tight little space. How tall is that wall of rocks?
Well, it's probably about a foot high, give or take.
It looks more menacing to me than that.
Yeah, that's probably the angle of the shot. It's about shin height, really.
Okay, so it's an ankle biter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah.
So it turns out that maintaining the koi pond is getting to be a much more expensive proposition than I guess we had counted on. So what we're looking to do is actually take down the rock wall, maybe, you know, squirrel away the rocks for another purpose, and take out the pond entirely and fill it up and make a larger yard. How do you fill up a great big honking hole in the yard and make sure that, you know, I'm not creating problems with settling or drainage, or do I have to worry about, like, what was left behind by the fish pond, or, you know what I'm saying?
So, well, actually, the stuff that's at the bottom of the fish pond is God's fertilizer.
Right.
I mean, all the muck down at the bottom with all the fishy poop and degraded plant material, that's condensed cream of corn, baby. That's, you know, that's got to get to plants somewhere. Now, I seem to recall that the pond is 3 feet deep, right?
Yeah, at its deepest. It sort of has a shallow end that's maybe about a foot deep and a deeper end that I think goes to maybe about 3.
How large is the deep end, the 3-foot part?
It's sort of half and half. So the pond is about 12 feet or so long. So half of it's kind of the shallow end and half of it's the deep end.
That is, they do need a lot of room, those fish. Those are monstrous. I didn't realize the pond was 2 different depths. What's the chance of breaking it in half and keeping just a little water feature at one end that doesn't have any fish in it, where you can, you know, there's all these great aquatic plants, and it's great to have a little water in the backyard for wildlife and stuff. You'd get lots of birds and butterflies, dragonflies. And if you just left the 3-foot part, filling in a foot deep pond would be a piece of cake.
Okay.
Right?
I think so.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to figure out logistically, when we sort of have the size of the pond, it's kind of like, how are we doing that? I don't know.
I think first you get the fish out.
Right.
And then you use a submersible pump to get the water out.
Mm-hmm.
and then you break down the wall, which is it mortared in place?
Or? I don't think so.
Okay, you'll find out soon enough. It's all these kind of fieldstone things on their side, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So you'll move those, and then once the pond is empty, you can just pull out the liner and save that for a tarp if you need it or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you just want to reclaim this entire space.
And then fill in the gaps with sand and then topsoil? Or?
No. You would go out and you would get a big load of very high-grade topsoil delivered, and you wouldn't muck about. You would just fill it up with topsoil, especially if you're going to sow a lawn.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you're just outside of Philly, so your time to sow the lawn is like over the next month. You'd have to work really fast if you wanted to put in a cool season lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, what I would suggest is you go through the schmagaggy of pumping out the pond, change it over to the smaller pond, just the deep area,
mm-hmm.
and then have somebody come who's handy who can put in a little retaining wall, and then you fill in the 1 foot tall space, which will be a piece of cake, and then you can sow seed there, you know, probably maybe even so small you could lay sod even in the spring or a little later than you could put in grass seed. And then you'd have the rocks to build a raised bed somewhere, or and they're not even rocks, they're field stones, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I like keeping the 3 foot area as a pond, getting rid of the rocks and filling in the 1 foot area simply out of convenience. It seems to me like it would be the easiest thing to do. And then if 3 years from now you hate the water feature, you can fill that in for half the work.
And then as a water feature without fish, what do I need to do in terms of maintaining that with, you know, like, so it's not just becoming a breeding ground for West Nile virus?
There's a natural substance called BTI, mosquito dunks, that you toss in there, and it totally prevents mosquitoes breeding.
Okay, great.
Piece of cake.
That sounds like a terrific plan. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Michael. How are you?
I'm fine here in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Well, how could you not be fine? You dog.
No, it's a little overcast today, you know.
Oh, we'll send a care package. Oh, it's overcast in St. Croix. Call out the National Guard. And I'm sure the water is warm 365 days a year to go swimming.
Too chilly for the locals in the wintertime, but the tourists don't mind.
Okay. All right. So what can we do for you, Michael, in St. Croix?
Well, I'm the vice chairman of the local environmental agency, St. Croix Environmental Association. And we have a community project requested by a housing community to put in community gardens. There are a number of unused concrete pads in this housing project, and we are contemplating using them because of the convenience factor and also because it's a good solid base, et cetera, et cetera. But I had to call you about whether concrete as a base for raised beds is a good idea, and if it is, what should we do to prepare it, et cetera.
When I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, there was a vogue in the mid-90s to actually build permanent raised beds with concrete sides for the beds. And at that time, we investigated whether the concrete would be too alkaline, would be changing the pH of the soil, and it just seemed to be a great idea. How large are these concrete pads?
Well, they're about 60 feet long by 20 or so wide, regular kind of a small house.
So
lot.
You'd be building raised beds on them that would be theoretically 4x8 or 4 foot by something, and then you have concrete walkways in between, man. No weeding, no muddy feet. I think it's go, 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 go. The only question is, what are you going to build the sides with, and do you have enough natural material, compost and high-quality topsoil, to fill the beds with? Sometimes in the tropics, finding compost or fertile soil can be a real problem.
We do have fertile soil. St. Croix used to be known as the Garden Isle of the Caribbean when sugar and cotton were king.
Well, make sure you follow the basic rule of raised beds and don't make them any wider than 4 feet so that you don't have any issues with soil compaction or tilling or anything like that. Obviously, you have a 12-month growing season down there. If it does get even slightly chilly in winter, that's when you can grow your greens and your broccoli and stuff like that. Is there other concrete around that could be used for the sides?
We believe that we'd be able to organize some donation from a local lumber store. The other question is, of course, we use treated lumber here because of the termite. We've got 27 different kinds of termites here.
And so this would be really old-school treated wood. This would be creosote and arsenic and...
I think it's copper and arsenic.
You know,
like
sometimes donations are not worth the money it costs the people. I think you should be all concrete all the time. I think that with stone, you'd never have an issue. It would never wear down. It's not putting anything unnatural into the island. You don't need to bring toxins there. Bricks, poured concrete. Cinder blocks, absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything
well,
other
is current technology here.
Yeah.
So.
Because of your climate and because of your insects, go strong. Don't be the little pig that built the house of straw, man.
Yeah, we're gonna move on this. I'll let you know how it goes. Send you some pictures.
Please do, and great luck to you, sir.
Great talking to you, Mike. I listen every week religiously.
On how do you receive us?
I get you on WVNJ Public Radio out of St. Thomas.
Oh, great.
Whether I can grow what you talk about or not, I'm still interested.
My money's on you, Mike.
Okie doke.
Take care.
Thanks, Mike.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll appear at Burpee's historic Ford Hook Farm in Doylestown, PA from noon to 2 next Saturday, August 25th. And I'll be at the Silverside Church Green Fair in Wilmington, Delaware on Saturday, September 15th, and at the Mount Laurel, New Jersey Library on Sunday, October 6th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to landscape to prevent ticks, the best way to prevent dandelions, plantains, and other weeds right now, and lots more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is having an open house at their historic Ford Hook Farm headquarters in Doylestown on August 24th and 25th, featuring garden tours, guest lectures, and tomato tastings. Details at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
A stroke can rob us of our ability to speak, to move, to understand. The new Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital uses an interventional approach to the rapid treatment of stroke and aneurysm. Formed in collaboration with stroke experts from Jefferson's Faculty Practice Plan and the Jefferson Neuroscience Network, they use minimally invasive techniques to avoid open brain surgery, to prevent disabilities, and to save lives. The Mainline Health Neurovascular Center at Bryn Mawr Hospital supports WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, something I never knew before. I always tell you that corn gluten meal makes a great way to feed your cool season lawn in the fall. But now I'm finding out that with the correct timing, you can prevent next year's weeds, or at least some of them. You won't want to miss the question of the week. And of course, we got lots more of your fabulous phone calls coming up. But right now, a very important interview. We're going to talk about how to prevent ticks with landscaping and personal protection. All right, as promised, it's time to welcome our guest today, Mr. Bob Oley, who is a spokesperson for and a member of the board of directors of TBDA, the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Well, now, the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance is a national group devoted to helping people be more aware of how to prevent ticks in their landscape?
That's certainly part of it, and part of it is raising money toward finding a cure for tick-borne diseases, finding diagnostic testing for tick-borne diseases, and educating the public about tick-borne diseases and prevention.
Now, ticks are nasty little arachnids. Everybody knows about Lyme disease, although I think they are woefully misinformed about the different symptoms, the different ways Lyme disease can present itself. My wife had the unfortunate experience of having her knee swell up with fluid a couple years back and went to the family doctor. He drained it, said, these things happen. It filled back up with fluid. He drained it again. And then when it filled back up again, he sent her to an orthopedic guy who, you know, congratulations to him. He took one look at her knee and he said, I think you have Lyme disease. And I had never heard of joint swelling, at least, you know, joint swelling is listed on this. But you think, oh, you feel achy, you're tired. I mean, her knee looked like a balloon in the Macy's parade, you know.
The joint swelling, believe it or not, Mike, is a very big symptom of Lyme disease. And when Lyme disease was first being investigated in Lyme, Connecticut in the 1970s, they were investigating a group of children that all had were diagnosed with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which is obviously swelling on the knee joints. And that's what brought that to the attention of the authorities, that there was just an unusual number of cases of JRA. So believe it or not, it is one of the many, many symptoms of Lyme disease, and there's over 100 symptoms of Lyme disease, and joint swelling is a very big one, especially the large joints of the body.
But I'd say that's lesser known by the general public. Everybody thinks if they find a tick attached to themselves, then they wait for the distinctive bullseye rash. And then anything that happens after that, anything bad, they get hit by a car, that was the tick's fault.
You know, Mike, the bullseye rash that you mentioned, most people don't even see a bullseye rash, and lots of people don't even get it.
Most people don't see the tick, correct?
That's correct.
Let's talk about the so-called deer tick, which I even hate that name, because it's my understanding that a lot of deer ticks never see a deer, but they all have to spend part of their life cycle on field mice. And the ticks that, if it's my understanding is correct, the ticks that give you the worst disease are so small, they're almost impossible to see.
Yeah, the size of these ticks, Mike, are almost microscopic in some cases. When a tick is the first stage of a tick is a larval stage, and that's about the size of a speck of sand. And then the next stage, which is the nymphal stage, that's about the size of a poppy seed on a bagel.
But these can both bite you.
They can both bite you. And
and you're not going to look down and see a tick. You're going to think, oh, it's a little scab or a thorn.
Correct. Absolutely. And the problem with ticks are that when they do bite you, they inject a painkiller in you so that you won't even feel the tick when the tick is on you. And if it's on your back, if it's in your hair, if it's in your back of your knees or your groin, you might not even ever notice it's there. And you're absolutely right. It's the size of a freckle, and it's so very, very tiny, it's almost impossible to see.
One of the things we've discussed in depth on this show when we've talked about tick prevention is mouse control. Get the mice out of your habitat, or as you probably know, because you're a professional in this, there's a lot of clever ways to treat the mice in the field that don't even harm the mice, but they kill the ticks on the mice.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting ways. I mean, one way is there's a company that makes these tubes that have cotton balls in the tubes that are impregnated with a chemical called permethrin. And the mice will go into these tubes and take the cotton and bring it back to their burrow or their nest and use it in their nest. And then the permethrin that's on the cotton ball is a neurotoxin for ticks, and any ticks that are on the mice will be killed by the cotton that's impregnated with the permethrin.
And one of the things I've loved about these tubes is, even though this is a synthetic chemical, and technically that's not kosher in my world, right, it's not being sprayed around. It doesn't get in the water. It doesn't get on the environment. I mean, if you're a mammalist, for instance, it doesn't even hurt the mouse. It actually helps the mouse because it kills any ticks on them.
Right. It's perfectly safe to use, and it doesn't harm the environment, and it's one way to get at getting rid of the ticks.
And one of the biggest pieces of education is ticks don't hang out on well-manicured lawns, right? They're in damp, overgrown areas. And literally, right, they're up at the top of tall pieces of grass or halfway up a weed just waiting for something to impact them so they can jump on.
Right. You're absolutely right, Mike. Ticks love a humid environment. If you have a lawn that's in the sunlight and where the grass is cut short, very highly unlikely you'll find a tick in that environment. However, the woods are loaded with ticks, and if and there's an area along the woodlands where your grass meets the woodlands or
isn't
your garden.
Isn't that the most dangerous area?
It is the most dangerous. It's called the ecotone area. That is where you'll find most of your ticks in that area. You'll find them around ornamental plantings. You'll find them around gardens. So you're absolutely right. The other thing you can do along your woodland edge or your grass where your lawn meets the woodland edge is to have a 3 to 4 foot wide wood chip or mulch buffer along that edge, and that tends to keep the ticks from crossing across from the woodland into your grassy property, into your lawn area. So
you're actually making a kind of a, you know, I realize there's no water in it, but it's like a moat around your castle.
You're absolutely right. What you want to do is create tick-safe zones on your property and know where you can go on your property and feel reasonably safe that you're not going to get bitten by a tick. Ticks will wait on the grass for you to come by. They actually, quite interestingly enough, have a they have no eyes. They have a
they have no eyes?
No eyes. They have a sensory organ on their front of their legs that actually picks up CO2. Like mosquitoes. Picks up vibration, picks up heat. And they can tell when you're walking by, and they'll get very excited.
So it's like Daredevil in Marvel Comics. They have a radar sense.
You're absolutely right. And they're quite advanced for a tick. And so they'll just wait there. And if you're a bit of your clothing, your skin just touches them, they latch on in a split second. And then they start climbing up your body and looking for a place to attach. But and then again, this is something called questing that all ticks do. And so it's.
And once they get on you, do they always move up?
They do. Ticks, it's something called positively geotropic. Ticks tend to move towards your head area. They're looking for, it's programmed in the tick, they're looking for thin-skinned areas.
Oh.
So they'll go to your ear, they'll go to your head, the back of your neck. And that's not to say they
won't. So thin-skinned.
Correct.
So that's why I don't get bit very often.
Yeah, could be. I don't know. But that's not to say they won't attach between your toes. That's not to say they won't attach on your behind your knee, in your groin area. They like moist areas. On your back, if they're walking up your body and they hit a constriction, let's say a bra strap, they'll stop that constriction and it takes them 15 minutes to 2 hours to attach, and you'll never know that they were there.
But
never.
You do have time. After they attach, right? Before there's any disease transmission.
Mike, you've got a certain amount of time to pull it off, and there is a part of the medical community believes that a tick won't transmit Lyme disease for 24 hours. There are a lot of people that
don't
agree
with that. I was
thinking
more in the 8-hour range.
Yeah, well, there are other diseases like anaplasmosis, which you can get within a couple hours of the tick being attached. Yeah. The problem with getting a tick bite is you can get not just only Lyme disease, but you can get a myriad of other
spotted
diseases.
Fever
Rocky Mountain
killed
spotted
my
fever.
Friend in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. You can get, and believe it or not, Mike, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, I think it's going to be more in the Rockies or a Colorado area. The East Coast is loaded
name.
With it.
It's just a name, yeah.
And but it's one of the tick-borne diseases that you can get from a tick. Probably the most important thing you can do is take a personal protection aspect of tick control. And that's wearing clothing that's been pre-treated with permethrin or clothing that you spray yourself.
But it's remarkably effective. It's what the military uses.
It absolutely is. And in fact, the military now on all their troops going overseas, they all have clothing that's been pre-treated with permethrin. And it's not just for ticks. It's for mosquitoes and other insects.
I find it works better than DEET.
Oh, it absolutely does. In fact,
and there's no human contact. It's on your clothing. It's
right.
Not on your skin.
It's bonded to your clothing. So it's the delivery system is your clothing. It's not your skin. In fact, if you have a choice of going out in the field, walking through a meadow, or doing gardening, your choice should be clothing that's been treated either by yourself or pre-treated. The other thing that's interesting is that you can send your clothing out to be treated.
No!
Absolutely. There's a company in North Carolina, which is the company that came up with the process for impregnating clothing with permethrin called Insect Shield.
Insect Shield, yes.
And
I get emails from
Greensboro, North Carolina. They're a U.S. company, and you can send your, if you have a favorite gardening clothes that you wear, you can send them to this company, and for a very small fee, they will treat it. And it's good for like over 70 washings.
And I was going to say, that's going to be much longer effectiveness than like the 4 to 6 weeks I get from the sprays I use myself on
absolutely.
My clothing.
Absolutely. The spray you use yourself, that'll last you 5 or 6 washings.
Yeah.
And then, but most people, ticks usually start climbing very on your feet or your legs and start working their way up. If you spray your shoes once a month with permethrin, if you make sure your socks are sprayed, you're going a long, long way in making sure you prevent yourself from getting bitten by a tick. You know, when you wear the clothing that's pre-treated, that's probably the best thing you can do.
To me, it's the perfect trade-off, because you are using a little bit of insecticide, but you're not spraying it on the environment. You can't hurt any good insects. It's harmless to you. It's harmless to your pets. The permethrin is such a low dose, it can't hurt your cat, they are sensitive right. to higher doses. And it allows you to enjoy right. this outdoor world.
Right.
All right. Excellent, excellent information. Our guest has been Bob Oley. He's a spokesperson and a member of the board of directors of the TBDA, the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. They're on the web. Now, this is a tough one. It's tbdalliance.org. And, of course, we'll put a link to their website up at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Bob Oley from the Tick-Borne Disease Alliance. Keep up the good work, and thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you for inviting me.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm doing well, Mike. How are you, sir?
And I'm doing very well, thank you.
And where are you?
I am about an hour east of Nashville, Tennessee.
All right, very good. What can we do for Mike in Tennessee?
Here's a quick story, okay? I'm a paramedic, firefighter, fly fishing guide, and my family and I bought a house out on a trout stream about 2.5 years ago, moved out to the country.
Yeah.
And it's an unbelievable environment for gardening. The water in the river is about 54 degrees year-round. So all summer long on these hot, humid mornings, the river pumps fog out and just fills this valley with this cool, dense, wet fog.
Oh, it sounds
and
sweet.
Everything grows phenomenally, okay? The problem that I'm running into is apparently Johnson grass is a native grass here. And this stuff has got like this mat for a root system. Then I tilled my garden spot. We tilled a 50 by 50 garden and then like a 10 by 30 garden. And when I tilled these gardens, they were great for the first year. The second year, Johnson grass started coming up in it. And now going into the third year here, this Johnson grass is coming up so thick that I'm having to, weed my garden with a lawnmower. You know, I've been pulling it and pulling it and hiring neighbor kids to come over and pull it.
Mike, the Johnson grass wins that fight. That fight. You know, if you're a paramedic, you come along somebody who's drunk or they've taken some drugs and they're combative, do you go one-on-one with them?
Yeah, of course not.
You got to be smarter than the Johnson grass. Now, first of all, if you're going to put in a garden, the last thing you want to do is till up and put in a truck patch. That's like 19th century. What you want to do is build raised beds that are going to be over top of the soil, with a full layer of cardboard on the bottom that you're going to fill with a nice mixture of compost and topsoil so that there is no fight with the Johnson grass. The Johnson grass will not show up anymore and you will win by default. Now, there's two ways to prepare the surface. One of them involves giving up a segment of this area to be garden for an entire summer, but you would start out without any Johnson grass. And that would be to till up a dedicated area one last time, rake away as much of the green as you can. You'd want to get this going very early in the spring, as soon as you could work the soil. Level the soil perfectly, saturate the soil till it can hold no more water, and then cover it with 2 mil clear plastic, pin the edges down, and let it cook all summer long. That's called soil solarization. It will kill every weed seed, every disease, and yet when you take off the plastic at the end of the year and build your raised beds, the soil will have improved in quality from the cooking. It's absolutely miraculous. Or your other option is you can scalp the Johnson grass repeatedly, like twice a week for a couple weeks in a row until you've really got it down low and you've exhausted a lot of the energy reserves. Then
right.
you would cover the area with a single piece of cardboard. You know, make sure it covers everything, and you would build raised beds over top of the cardboard that are 4x8. The reason they're only 4 feet wide is then you would never step in them. So you would never compress the soil. You'd never need to till it again. You'd start with weed-free soil. You'd never have a weed in there as long as you mulch the empty beds or grew cover crops in them over the winter. Build raised beds, and weeds you will pull no longer.
That's wonderful.
All right, Mike, good luck, sir.
Thank you. Me and my back, thank you.
Yeah. All right, take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners across the nation that Harvest Festival time is coming up, a great chance to sample, purchase, and celebrate locally produced foods. For instance, here in Pennsylvania, we have the famed Pocono Garlic Festival on September 1st and 2nd and the Bowers Chili Pepper Festival on September 7th and 8th. But don't go looking for all the spicy hot details on these and other harvest happenings at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to use corn gluten meal in the fall to prevent weeds. I'm Weedy Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Weed-Free Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
Here's more of Mike in just a moment. This is WHYY.
I'm Bob Garfield, and on this week's On the Media, we remember Helen Gurley Brown, who created Cosmo Magazine with a very simple formula.
She really did believe that women had wiles and men had needs, and you just had to put the two together and everything would work out.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Tomorrow morning at 11 on WHYY.
The WHYY Connections Festival rocks the Great Plaza at Penn's Landing. Yola Tango. Frank Turner.
After all, it was rock and roll.
Maps and Atlases.
And the moon stood stock still.
The Lawsuits.
I can't wait to get down to Tennessee.
Baby and Achilles. And more. Saturday, September 8th. More at WHYY.org/Connections Festival.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. Brand new information, new to me at least, about how to use corn gluten meal in the fall to prevent weeds. Yes, we always talk about using it in the spring to prevent crabgrass, but we're talking dandelions, plantain, clover, chickweed. You won't believe it. Well, maybe you'll believe it. It's coming up right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Susan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
It's great to have you on. Where are you?
I'm in Landenburg, Pennsylvania, which right on the White Clay Creek, which is where Pennsylvania meets Maryland and Delaware.
Okay, down by Longwood Gardens, down in the Brandywine.
Yes, uh-huh.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have kind of a unique house. I actually call it a tree house. I'm kind of up in the treetops over the White Clay Creek. And my house was literally a belt around an oak tree. And the oak tree now has gotten so large that it's starting to heave up my entryway. And it's about an inch away from my roof. And I very sadly am going to have to take it down. And it's kind of a heartbreaker for me. And I'm trying to look beyond the cutting of the tree to what I can do with the stump after it's gone so that it's still attractive and it's still a unique part of my house.
Now, you sent us a picture.
I did.
Of this. And it's the way you describe it, it's almost like the tree's in the middle of the house. But the picture, it looks like the tree is coming up kind of awkwardly and off-center through a small deck, and the trunk looks like it's right next to the siding of the house.
Yes, you're right.
And there's just a tiny little hole in the deck, really no bigger than the tree anymore, right?
That's correct. I've opened that up two times. I've lived here 12 years, and I've cut that tree out twice. I've done all kinds of things to try to save that tree. But I'm afraid its time has come.
And the time has come not because of the canopy of the tree, but because the root system is now affecting the foundation of your house.
Well, yes, and it's an inch away from my roof line, so it just can't put on any more girth without really damaging my house.
And you've had estimates for taking down the major part of the tree.
Yes, I have.
And weren't they shocking?
Well, I've got a great tree guy out here that I really trust, and I have two other canopy trees that need to come down. So, yes, it was a little shocking, but I've gotten over that piece, and now I'm trying to figure out what to do.
Very good.
With
yeah.
What's left.
And you're very smart to get all the work done at once. What we normally tell people when you have to take down a tree somewhere or a tree dies, it is great to leave a lot of the trunk behind, 8 to 10 feet of the trunk, if it's a viable option, because a lot of insect-eating birds will then colonize the dead trunk. Woodpeckers and chickadees and the titmouse, nutthatches, all of these birds and all of nature loves to leave the tree trunk standing if that's viable. But you don't want to do that with a tree that is almost coming through your house. I looked at your picture over and over again, and I know you had thought about having the trunk carved into some sort of a shape.
Yeah.
And then preserved. I think that would be your only option. And what I would suggest you do is if you do, you know, leave enough of the tree behind so that you'd have a carving that comes out of your deck, so to speak, that would actually look like an extension of the deck, that you would have an arborist or the artist or somebody drill some holes into the tree and put in borate-treated rods. That sounds like a nuclear device, but it's just boric acid that's been saturated in wood. And what this would do would get rid of any termites that entered the tree from the base of the tree. Because that's one thing, you've got a wood house and you've got a wood tree. The termites in our region, in Pennsylvania, will not infest live wood. But once that trunk dies, that is very attractive to them. But then you would want to have it carved into a nice shape, and it wouldn't have to be like a statue of, hey, Statue of Liberty would actually look pretty good there. You know, generally they do eagles and stuff, but you could just do an artistic design. It wouldn't cost you that much. And as long as you, you know, inserted these treated rods in the bottom, I don't think it would be a termite problem.
Okay.
And because you can't pull the stump anyway, you'd have to do that anyway. You'd have to put these rods into the stump because the stump would be attractive to termites. And you obviously can't pull it. Your house would fall down.
Exactly.
So that's what I suggest you do. You leave enough that you can just carve it into a nice pyramid kind of shape, a nice obelisk, and then make sure you put those borate-treated rods in the bottom, and I think everybody goes home happy.
Great. Okay, that's really, really helpful.
All right, Suze, now you sent us a before picture. We're going to put it up on the website so that people can see it with this show. We want to see the after picture.
All righty. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Richard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. I'm just south of Kansas City by 100 miles and suffering a big drought.
Okay, very good. Well, except for the drought part.
Yeah, it's been about 50 days without a significant rain.
Mm.
I'm losing some fruit trees, but I think it's, I've been watering them, so I don't think it's the drought. I think it's, well, I know it's the rabbits and the deer.
Well, how old are these trees, Richard?
Well, anywhere from 2 to 5 years old.
Oh, okay. That is the tender period. That's really where they need to be protected from, as you say, rabbits and deer. Did you use tree guards at all?
No, but I have started get some chicken wire and make a circle around it, maybe 8 or 9 inch diameter to keep the rabbits away from them.
Right, because they've been eating the tender bark.
Yeah.
And have they girdled the tree? That is, have they eaten the bark around in a circle?
Yes, they have.
Well, then the trees probably are not going to make it, man.
Yeah, I realize that.
What kind of fruit trees did you put in?
Well, mostly pears and apples. I have a few peach, too, but they do less well than the other, than apples and pears.
Of the three trees you mentioned, pears are somewhat easy care. Apples are difficult, and peaches are close to impossible. You really have to heavily prune the trees. You got to thin the fruit. You got to be on the lookout for all sorts of pests and diseases. But, of course, the reward is nature's most luscious fruit. So, but peaches and apples are not lazy man's fruits. The way you get a better crop is you prune the trees in late winter, early spring, just as they're blooming, and you remove a good third of the tree when you do that. And then when the new fruits come on, you must thin the fruits to where you're taking off at least 3/4 of the little baby fruits. Do you do that?
No, I generally don't.
See, you'll never get a good crop if you don't thin the fruits of peaches and apples. You will get a decent crop with pears, but apples and peaches must be thinned. That's what a lot of people don't realize when they put these plants in. And when you open up the canopy, when you prune the trees correctly, when you remove all the extra fruits, I have found over the 8-10 years that I've been growing peaches, the more aggressive I get with those, the less pest and disease problems I have.
Yeah.
But there are natural sprays for the little caterpillars that get inside peaches and apples. The old form of BT, which is known as Dipel, it's the organic caterpillar killer. You spray that at the right time, and typically these are pests like the oriental fruit moth, which is a moth that lays its eggs at night, and then the little caterpillars tunnel in, and they sit right next to the pit and the peaches. You know, if you want easy care, then you can let the peaches and apples expire, because you really have to be there in the spring. You really got to thin the fruits. The pears, I would imagine you're having, as long as the trees are protected when they're young, you should have good success with the pears, and they're not as much work.
Okay. I'm getting tired of buying replacements. I was wondering, is there any way to put the fruit in, one of those little containers and grow apple trees and pear trees?
Well, apple trees, no, because they will not come true from seed. There's an old expression, the seeds of the sweetest apple grow the bitterest fruit. You can theoretically grow the other trees from seed, but it adds like 5 to 8 years before you're going to get your first fruits.
Okay. One other thing. Can you take the sprouts that are coming up from, say, a dead tree or a live tree, try to get them to grow, and will they be?
Yes. Yes, you can do this. It's a slightly difficult technique, propagation from cuttings. And typically what you would do, though, is you would buy rootstock to put your cutting onto so that the rootstock would be very hardy and very disease-resistant and good for your area. And then the graft that you cut into it would produce the kind of fruit you want. So you're still buying something.
Okay, well, there's some of my dead trees are sprouting, and I was just wondering if I could just maybe get one of the sprouts and maybe it grow up.
Well, what you want to do is you want to go online and you want to research hardwood and softwood cuttings. Okay? They would be hardwood now, they'd be softwood in the spring. But that would walk you through it. It's a very difficult process. It takes a while to learn, but once you learn it, it's a skill you'll always have.
Yeah.
All right, Rich?
All right. I thank you very much for the information.
And especially over winter, don't forget to protect these new young trees with tree guards and make sure the guard doesn't bite into the trunk of the tree. It should just float around the tree to keep the rabbits and the deer away.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Corn gluten meal timing for fall weed prevention. Alexis Landis, You Bet Your Garden producer, read off this week's timely questions.
Well, we heard from a couple of people. Dan in Lansdale, Pennsylvania writes, Okay, I'll start using the corn gluten meal you're always talking about on my lawn. Now, in the spring, you say to put it down when the forsythia bushes begin to bloom. But how will I know the best time to put it down in the fall? We also heard from Diana in Northern Virginia, who writes, What's the best time to apply corn gluten for fall weed prevention? I know the rule of thumb for spring is when the forsythia bloom, but I don't recall the time frame for the fall.
Well, that might be due to the fact that I don't think I've ever recommended a weed suppression time frame for the fall. When I mention corn gluten at this time of year, it typically is an excellent choice for the big fall feeding that cool season lawns like bluegrass and fescue need to recover from summer heat. I've really only discussed corn gluten's ability to prevent weed seeds from sprouting in the spring, when its natural pre-emergent herbicidal activity can prevent the crabgrass seed lurking in your turf from successfully germinating into America's most despised lawn weed. But these questions got me thinking about chickweed, a, quote, winter annual that springs up when most other plants are going dormant, and that sometimes does get pesky in lawns. So I emailed our resident turf grass and corn gluten expert, Iowa State University's Dr. Nick Christians, the researcher who pioneered the use of corn gluten as an all-natural weed and feed, to see if chickweed or any other late-season weeds were about to germinate. His response literally floored me. He wrote back, actually, many broadleaf weeds germinate right after the summer stress period is over. Dandelion, clover, and plantain are the main ones. Then the winter annuals like henbit and common chickweed usually germinate a little later. Dandelion, plantain, clover? Yikes, Nick, why didn't you ever mention this before? His reply, you never asked me before. You always seemed obsessed with crabgrass timing. Oof. Guilty as charged. Well, it's nice to know that I still have new things to learn. So I asked Nick, what is the ideal timing here? He replies, to control dandelion, plantain, and clover in a cool season turf, I would apply the corn gluten pretty much as soon as the summer heat stress is over. For some people, that could be as early as August 15th. September 1st would be fine for most areas, and applying it a little later than that would still catch some of the winter annuals. Just be aware that corn gluten will have no effect on existing weeds, just the seeds that would have sprouted the next generation. Let's use dandelion as an example of how this works. All the puffball seeds that were spread in the spring have been lying dormant over the summer, explains Nick. When the weather cools down, the seeds germinate and form a little rosette, a very flat, low-to-the-ground plant part, from which the big obvious dandelion springs up when winter is over. In our test plots here at Iowa State, we saw remarkable control of dandelion and clover with early spring and late summer feedings of corn gluten meal. But you have to be both diligent and patient, he warns. It typically takes around 3 years to see a noticeable difference and around 5 years for the area to be weed-free. And it's like crabgrass, I asked, right? If you miss the application window and the weed seeds do germinate, the corn gluten will just feed those plants as well as the lawn. Yes and no, says Nick. That is pretty much the case with crabgrass in cool season lawns in the spring, because the turf grasses are about to get knocked back hard by the summer heat, while the crabgrass is going to get stronger as the weather gets hotter. But in the fall, cool season grasses like fescue and bluegrass are gaining strength and can outcompete some of these weeds when both are fed, especially if the grass was in decent shape at the end of the summer. Now, in the past, I have talked about how dandelion and clover virtually disappeared in those Iowa State test plots after a few years without any kind of direct action against them. But I always thought that it was because the corn gluten was providing the kind of slow-release natural nitrogen that helps turf grass outcompete weeds, and the fact that those test plots were always cut at the right height and watered correctly. It's a combination of factors for sure, says Nick. A healthy, well-managed turf will outcompete quite a few of those weeds, but stopping a lot of their seeds from germinating can give you a big leg up. Thanks, Nick. I'll just add the requisite warning that because corn gluten prevents the germination of all seeds, you can't use it and then sow grass seed successfully. You have to get the new grass up and growing for a week or two before you feed the lawn with corn gluten. Well, that sure was some timely last-minute advice about using corn gluten meal to prevent next year's weeds now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over carefully and follow links to lots more articles about corn gluten and correct lawn care. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pummel me with plantain if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired report, or your wretched refuse team towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line and perhaps check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section, and or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Kevin, don't call me Merv Griffin. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath, who invites you to check out the new information and updates at our Facebook page every single day. And go like us already. The extremely likable Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We already like our new production assistant, Joanna Hatzis. Nobody doesn't like our esteemed editor, Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And, well, my mother used to say she liked me. So I'll see you next week. Well, she did. Are your mulberries making a mess when they drop their fruits? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how you can turn trash into treasure by harvesting what some say is one of the best-tasting berries of all. Bless your fabulous phone calls.
Whether it's tomatoes or tomatillos, tangerines or tarragon, Mike helps us take up a gardening template that will lead to toothsome treats. Join us Saturday morning at 11 on You Bet Your Garden, right here on WHYY.
The Brandywine River Museum supports WHYY and presents tours of Andrew Wyeth's studio. The artist's private retreat is now open for tours. Visitors can see where Wyeth created some of his iconic works of art, learn about their creative process, and see his library, photos, brushes, paints, and much more. Tours take place Tuesdays through Sundays. Details about Andrew Wyeth's studio tours are available online at brandywinemuseum.org.
The foreclosure crisis has affected nearly every American community. This week,